right, I promise you this morning, we will be in John. After last week, I understand if you question me. We will be in John chapter 6 this morning when we get there. As I was looking through things this week and writing my sermon, I was reminded of the story that another preacher tells about his years growing up. He grew up as the son of a preacher, and he says that it was their regular practice. Their family would go to church, and before church, mom would put something, a roast or something that could cook for a while. She would put it in the oven, and they would leave, and they would go to church, preparing to go home after church and eat a meal together as a family, sit around the family table and eat a meal. He said the problem was his dad had this habit. His dad had this habit of regularly inviting people over for lunch on Sunday afternoon. They would get to church, and as families do at church, they would get separated by different things. And as a minister's family, that tends to happen a little bit more just because the nature of the day and the work of the preaching minister. But he would invite somebody over for lunch. And invariably, he would do it on the days when his wife had fixed something or only had enough to fix for their family. And it wasn't like he would warn her as soon as he invited somebody. Rather, they would be on their way home from church when across the car seat, he would say, "Oh, and by the way, I invited a whole army, no, not a whole army. I invited so-and-so and their family over for lunch today." And said, almost every time his dad did it, his mom graciously simply started trying to figure out how she could stretch the meal that she had prepared for their family to include another family. Now, I don't know that I have ever done that. I have at times asked and said, would it be okay if we invite, and never on Sunday. I wouldn't do that on Sunday morning to my beautiful wife, because she doesn't like to cook all the time anyway, and especially on Sundays. And so to say, hey, could we invite somebody over to share our leftovers from last night? Wouldn't be the right thing to do, but I can just imagine being in that situation and trying to figure out how are we going to stretch a meal that was meant for a family to feed another family. And that's where we find Jesus. Pardon me. That's where we find Jesus in John chapter 6, verses 1 through 13 this morning. Jesus has been healing, and Jesus has been teaching, and Jesus has been doing these miracles and gathering a crowd, and beginning in verse 1 of chapter 6, this is what John writes. He says, "After these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. A large crowd followed him because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. Then Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now, the Passover feast of the Jews was near. Therefore Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming to him, he said to Philip, 'Where are we to buy bread so that these may eat?' This he was saying to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii, that's roughly 8 months worth of wages for a daily worker. 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are these for so many people? Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now, there was much grass in the place, so that the men sat down in number about 5,000. Jesus then took the loaves, and having given thanks, he distributed to those who were seated. Likewise also of the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were filled up, he said to the disciples, gather up the leftover fragments so that nothing will be lost. So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments of 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten. Therefore, when the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, this is truly the prophet who is to come to the world. So we see here this situation that's growing and evolving as Jesus has been teaching and Jesus has been healing. People have heard the miraculous things that Jesus is doing. They've heard the wonderful teaching of Jesus that is unlike any teaching of their teachers of the day. And they are excited. They are excited to hear what Jesus has to say. They are excited because some of them are sick and some of them are infirm and some of them have disabilities, and they are coming to Jesus because they want to hear his teaching, but also because they want to be healed, and they have been following Jesus. And Jesus and his disciples, they try to get away from the crowd. The problem is the crowd, somebody has seen where Jesus is headed, and they begin to follow, and pretty soon the crowd begins to follow Jesus. The crowd begins to follow them, and they get up on this hillside, and Jesus continuing to do what Jesus has been doing. He continues to heal, and he continues to teach. And suddenly this large crowd begins to have a problem. You see, there is no food. They hadn't prepared to follow Jesus. They simply heard the message and they picked up and they began following him. Some of them maybe for days, and they had prepared for one day and they had found something for a second day, but the third day, the fourth day, however many days it was, they've been following Jesus, and suddenly this crowd is hungry. And that creates a problem. Because John here tells us that there are 5,000 men. 5,000 men have gathered around Jesus to hear his preaching and teaching, and they're all hungry. But if you look at the account that Matthew tells of this same event, Matthew makes a point to mention that there were 5,000 men beside women and children. There's 5,000 men gathered, but some of them have brought their wives with them. Some of them have brought their children with them. There are maybe a few women who have followed Jesus without a husband with them. And they also may have children. And so if you begin to look at it, it's easy to see that there's probably more than 10,000 people gathered on this mountainside along with Jesus and his 12 disciples. And possibly, possibly even more than 20,000 people who have gathered on this mountainside in this remote area outside of any of the local cities, and they're hungry. And you thought it might be bad if your spouse invited somebody over for Sunday dinner when you had something to feed your family, but you didn't think it was enough to feed another family. Think about this. You've got 20,000 people suddenly that you are trying to figure out how you're going to feed them a meal. Now today, 50,000 people, it might take a while, but we could cycle through McDonald's and Culver's and Steak and Shake, and we might get enough food for several thousand people. You could send them away, and they could get themselves something to eat. But in Jesus' day, where they're at, they were in a remote area, and I can kind of think about that. I grew up in western Nebraska, and when I was growing up, when I was up until about from 5 to 10, the nearest fast food restaurant was about 35, 40 miles away. When I was in high school, the nearest fast food chain restaurant was 52 miles away. When Brenna and I were first married, we lived in South Dakota, and we had to drive 40 some miles to the closest McDonald's. And there were people who lived north of us a little ways that would have had to drive 70 or 80 miles to the nearest fast food restaurant. So I can understand. You're out in a rural area, and you suddenly have lots of people to feed. And that's where Jesus and his disciples are at this point in time. They have a crowd of people who've gathered, and they don't have food enough to feed them all. There wasn't any RSVP from the crowd so that they could prepare for a large group of people. But Jesus, being the teacher that he is going to use this situation as an opportunity to see what his students, the disciples, have learned. In other words, he's going to give them a test. It's an educational opportunity. That's what we learned to call tests, is they were educational opportunities. And Jesus is going to test his disciples. And so he begins, he asks them this question: what will we feed them? What can we give to these people that they need? And I like what one commentator wrote. He says, the test is ultimately concerned with the recognition of Jesus' identity and the graciousness of God. In fact, even in this test itself, Jesus' identity and God's graciousness are evident. Jesus is acting like God. For in testing Philip, Jesus is treating him like God treated his own people in the Old Testament. What God was looking for in testing his people is faith. Trust that God would be loyal to his covenant obligations to care for his people. This question is meant to reveal Jesus as the presence of that gracious God who is providing the ultimate blessing, eternal life. Jesus is testing his disciples to see what it is that they have learned. They have been with him for a period of about a year now, according to John's recording of the story, because John records from Passover to Passover, and he begins at a Passover, and we're now about at the second Passover. So they have been following Jesus for about a year, and they have seen many miraculous signs. They have heard some great teaching from Jesus, and Jesus is testing them to see what it is that they have learned. And I find in life that many times Jesus is testing us, that God is testing us, and he's saying, what have you learned? And oftentimes we can find the tests of Jesus not in things that are going well, but in the needs of our lives. When we look at our own lives and we see the needs that we have, we can identify them as problems, or we can identify them as educational opportunities, as tests, to see how much we trust God. And in fact, Paul and Peter both tell us that the trials, and James says that the trials that we face in life, they're tests to grow and strengthen our faith, but also to see and prove the quality of our faith. And it's interesting that the word tests here in the Greek is periazon, and it has two different meanings. It can mean to test, like Jesus is doing with his disciples here, or it can mean to tempt. And the difference is found in context. When you read the story, you find if it is a trial, or if it is a temptation, if it is a test, or if it is somebody being tempted. And in this particular case, we see that it is Jesus testing his disciples. And as another commentator says, it says here it shows Jesus' method of training his disciples by challenging them with responsibility. They have seen what Jesus is doing, and now he is giving them an opportunity to use some of that knowledge in a real life situation and saying, okay, what will you do? And so he asks Philip this question. And probably the reason that he asks Philip in particular is because this is the region that Philip grew up in. This is where Philip was born and raised. And so Philip was familiar with the situation, the surroundings. He could see the large crowd, and he could put into perspective what was available. And so Jesus asked Philip this question, and I'm sure as Philip is thinking through this, he's looking out and he's saying, that is a lot of people, Jesus. Sunday dinner isn't going to be big enough for all of them. And then he begins to think about where they're at, and he says, not only is their Sunday dinner not going to be big enough for all of them, there isn't anywhere to send them. And so he makes this statement, and I just want to paraphrase it. He says, we can't afford to give crumbs to these people, even if we had 8 months worth of wages to buy food, Jesus. In other words, he's saying to Jesus, there is no way we can feed all of these people. The situation isn't right. There isn't enough place to buy food. We don't have enough money, even if we could buy food, to secure food for everyone, to even have a snack, let alone to feed them all and to meet their needs. And I love this because after Jesus asks Philip the question, Andrew, Peter's brother, and we don't often hear about Philip and Andrew. They're there, they're the disciples of Jesus, but they're kind of undermentioned. Of course, they're mentioned some more than some of the others, but I think Andrew sometimes has the same mentality as Peter. And that is, say something, and if it's wrong, just eat your shoe, because that's what you do, you know. And so Andrew here, Peter's brother, he says, hey, Jesus, I found this boy who has a Happy Meal. It's the Jewish version of the Happy Meal. It's barley loaves and fish, so you can have a filet of fish sandwich. See, it's the Jewish Happy Meal. And So Andrew says, "Hey, Jesus, I just have to tell you, I've searched around the crowd. I've gone out looking, and you know, the only thing I could find is a Happy Meal. How full are we going to fill these people with this little boy's Happy Meal? You know, I don't think I could go to McDonald's and order a Happy Meal and be completely satisfied. It would tide me over, and it would provide me some, I'm not going to say nourishment. I'm not sure there's much nourishment coming from McDonald's. Amen. But it would fill my stomach, at least for a little while." But he's looked and he said, "Jesus, we got nothing. We have nothing. I just have to ask, do you remember the nursery rhyme about old Mother Hubbard who went to her cupboard to fetch her poor dog a bone? Have you ever felt that way? Have you ever felt like the situation around you needs something, but you look at the situation and all you see is nothing? Nothing. And that's where Philip and that's where Andrew were at. They're looking at this test that Jesus is setting before them, and they're saying, "Yeah, we got nothing, Jesus. There's no way. There is nothing we can do." And the disciples, in this moment, at this point in time, they fail the test. They fail the test, but Jesus is going to give them another kind of lesson. Jesus, as the great teacher, has before him another teaching opportunity. Another situation that he can use to teach them a lesson. And so Jesus becomes the multiplier and the divider. Jesus is going to do something miraculous for the disciples to teach them a lesson. And so Jesus begins, he looks at the disciples and he says, "Okay, I'm going to give you some instructions. And they might sound a little ludicrous, but I want you to carry them out because you're going to see something that you don't believe." And so Jesus looks at his disciples and he says, "Okay, you go out amongst the crowd and you tell them to sit down in groups between 50 and 100. 50s and 100s. And so the people begin to sit down and John tells us that there was plenty of grass, and we may not think much about that. But it goes back to the time of year. It's making a point that the people had plenty of places to sit down. And it goes with what one of the other writers says when Jesus felt compassion because they were like sheep without a shepherd. There's plenty of grass. And in fact, Mark tells us it's not just plenty of grass, but it's green grass. And so the people sit down. They've got somewhere lush and somewhere beautiful to sit. It's the springtime. It's a nice, beautiful day, and they're sitting down. And in case you want to know, if there were just about 10,000 people, and they sat down in groups of 50, you'd have somewhere around 50 groups of 100 people. If you had 2,000 or 20,000 people and they sat down, you might have as many as 200 groups of people. So somewhere between 50 and 200 groups of people in groups between 50 and 100 have sat down on this mountainside, probably a plateau in the mountainous region, where they can spread out a little bit. And we all thought social distancing was something new. Jesus was practicing social distancing 2,000 years ago. Because as I was sitting at the Chamber of Commerce luncheon this week, listening to Dr. Roundcount, the superintendent of Mount Zion here, he began to tell us at one point how the kids were going to eat lunch. And he said some of them would be in a group of 50 people in their normal cafeteria, but he said several other groups of them would be sitting in the large gymnasium at the high school in groups of 50, separated by about 30 feet. And then you'd have another group of 50, and the same on the other side of the gym so that they could get all of the students an opportunity to eat lunch. And so Jesus is just way ahead of his time. Groups of 50 and groups of 100. And they're separated so that you can distinctively tell where the groups are. And Jesus begins to do this. And then it says that he took the time and he blessed the food. Again, that's one of the other gospel writers, because this is one miracle that all four gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, include in their gospel. This incident of feeding the 5,000. And so Jesus blesses the bread and he gives it to the people, and then he blesses the fish and he gives it to the people. And I'm just wondering when the miracles began. Did the miracle begin as Jesus was praying? Did suddenly there begin to appear extra loaves of bread while Jesus is praying? Or did the miracle begin at the moment that the disciples took a loaf and handed it to a group of 50, and they only had one loaf, and there's only five of them, and there's 50 groups here, Jesus. That's only one for every 10. And the first disciple handed one. Whoa, I got another one for the next. Or did it begin as the people began to break off bread, and they broke off, whoa, where's this bread coming from? You see, a miracle is just God doing what God always does, but doing it in fast forward. Have you ever watched a movie? I used to do this with VCR tapes. It's a little more difficult now, but you used to be able, well, even now, if you've got the right ones, you can like speed them up and watch them on fast forward. Well, that's what Jesus is doing here, is he's doing this miracle. And we don't know, John, Matthew, Mark, none of them tell us exactly how the miracle took place. They just all state that it did. But it's like fast forwarding, because all Jesus is doing is the same thing that happens naturally. You plant a seed and the wheat grows, and you take that wheat and you turn it into bread. And it takes several months. In fact, where I grew up, they grew hard red winter wheat, and they would plant it in October and harvest it at the beginning of July. So you had November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June. 8 months. 8 months that this wheat would start to grow, go dormant, start to grow again, and grow to maturity. Well, Jesus, in a moment, he goes not only from planting to growing to harvesting, but he also does the processing and the baking of bread like that. And fish multiply all the time. Where I graduated from high school, we were just a few miles from a state fish hatchery where they bred and grew the supply of rainbow trout that would be spread throughout the state of Nebraska and stocked in different lakes and streams. And you could go there and you could see one group of fish that were the breeding stock, and then you could see another group where all the fingerlings were, and there were a whole lot more fingerlings than there were breeding stock. And then if you went down a little ways to another section, they had ones that were a little bit bigger, minnows of some size, and then you could get to the place where they were large fish. But here's what it took. It took time. But Jesus, on this day, he miraculously, in a moment, produced fish and bread for the people. And the result is this. The result is that everyone ate. Not just some of the people. Not just this little boy with his happy meal. It wasn't just this little boy sharing his meal with the disciples. And so 14 people ate. Jesus, the boy, and the 12 disciples. It is 10 to 20,000 people sitting on the grass who've eaten. And Jesus Jesus can do that for us. Jesus can miraculously meet our needs. He doesn't always do it. In fact, if you read on from this, you find that the people wanted Jesus to keep providing miracle food for them, and they said, Jesus says, hold it. No. You ate once. That's good enough. If you want what I really have, you're going to listen to my teaching. And Jesus knows. Jesus sometimes allows those tests to come into our lives so that we can see the miraculous, but sometimes he lets us see who he is in other ways. Here the disciples go around, and just to multiply the miracle, they started with 5 loaves and 2 fish, and Jesus sends them out afterwards to collect the leftovers. You know, they needed something for lunch the next day, the disciples and Jesus did. So the disciples have these small baskets that they would carry stuff around in. My picture is like a picnic basket. And they collect 12 baskets full of leftover bread and fish. That's one for every disciple. Every disciple had their basket, and they went around, and each one of them collected lunch, not just for the next day, but for several days. Lunch and dinner and lunch and dinner. And they could have fish sandwiches for a week. You think turkey sandwiches for a day or two after Thanksgiving are bad. These guys, after Jesus does his miracle, they got fish sandwiches for a week or more. The people look and they see Jesus doing this, and their thought is of Moses, the prophet. The prophet, not just Moses himself, but the prophet that Moses proclaimed would come. And then it says that they tried to make Jesus their king by force. Jesus had something going on, and they thought, this man can give us food, surely he can free us from the Romans. And they wanted to make him their king. Before last week's sermon text, I mentioned that Jesus calmed the storm, and the disciples asked, who is this that even the winds and the water obey him? And then we looked at the exorcism of a man that was possessed by a legion of demons. And we said that Jesus is the master of the spiritual realm. Well, today, if we were to answer that question, we might say Jesus is a great teacher. But he's more than just a great teacher. We could agree with the people and say that he is the prophet that Moses said would come. But he's more than just another prophet, or even the greatest prophet. We might conclude that Jesus is a provider in the lines of Moses, like the people did. Or more accurately, Yahweh, because Yahweh is the one who provided the manna in the wilderness. But Jesus is more than just a provider. You see, the picture that John is painting with this sign is that Jesus is nature's master, aka the creator of the universe, aka Yahweh. You see, John's gospel begins by saying in verse 1, that the Word was God. And then in verse 14, he says that the Word took flesh and dwelt among us. And then near the end of his gospel message, he closes his gospel by saying, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. I don't know all that you are facing, but Jesus does. You may be right in looking at the situation like Philip and Andrew, logically trying to find an answer to your situation and concluding that there aren't any. All the while, Jesus is saying, sit down. I've got this. And waiting to show us his power, waiting to show you his power and his wisdom and his might. Like he did for the disciples on a mountainside with a group of 20,000 onlookers. You see, we serve a great and mighty God who loves us and wants to give us more than we could ever ask or even imagine. And it begins with his offer of life in the kingdom. And this morning, if you don't know Jesus as your Savior, we're going to sing one more song, and I'd invite you to come and to begin that relationship with him, because he wants to provide for you what nothing else can provide. And as followers of Jesus, as many of us are this morning, it's a reminder for us to leave it all at Jesus' feet and to simply sit down and wait and see, what is he going to do with your situation? Will he bless you so that others can see his blessing? Will he strengthen your faith so that others can endure? Or maybe this test is the one that will be your final test. And he'll say, come home. I don't know. I don't know what Jesus is doing in your life. But I know that he's got this.